Blog Talk Radio.
Crazy about, which is Birth.
Beautiful. I mean, but I forgot The Girl with the Pearl Earring. I thought the soundtrack of that was just magnificent.
Yeah.
But Birth is exceptional.
And you and I have the same reaction when we saw Birth and it started, and he actually speaks to this in this interview, just incredibly captivating from the beginning. And you actually, for the first time, you kind of perked up and thought, man, what music.
Oh, it was mind-blowing.
Yeah, music is just so, it's a little bland in service of the movie, and it's you can anticipate it and expect what it'll sound like. His scores are very captivating and original.
They are. Yeah. They really are.
We're talking, of course, about Alexandre Desplat, and he's one of the few composers whose musical expressions can take a film beyond mere images on the screen and straight up into the heavens. He's been honored with significant industry recognition, including a Golden Globe win for The Painted Veil and an Oscar nomination for The Queen, just nominated for a Golden Globe Award for his gorgeous score for Benjamin Button. Mr. Desplat calls us from London earlier today, where he's working at Abbey Road Studios, as I mentioned. And in this conversation, he discusses his collaboration with Fincher, the tone of the film's music, and his upcoming projects, which include Terrence Malick's upcoming film *Tree of Life*,
wow,
and the Meryl Streep Julia Childs movie, *Julie and Julia*.
Yeah, okay.
He worked on as well. And to close the show tonight, after this interview, stick around because we're going to premiere a track from his score to *Benjamin Button*. So I'm sure everyone will look forward to that. So here it is, Alexandre Desplat.
What drew you first to music? I understand you started playing the piano as a child. What drew you to that?
Well, my parents were very fond of listening a lot of different kind of music, and they just put the three children to the conservatory to learn how to play an instrument. And as my older sister did, when I was five, I went to near piano and I started learning piano. But my sisters were playing piano, so I got a little bit upset of doing the same thing as the girls were doing. So I liked what my father was listening to, which was Louis Armstrong and Coleman Hawkins, and I thought maybe trumpet would be good, I started learning trumpet until I had kind of a clash with my teacher and didn't like the teacher very much, and switched to flute, and that's how I became a flutist, and one day I just went into composing.
Right. You've been composing for film for quite a long time. You know, American audiences, you know, they might just be, you know, seeing your name for the last 4 or 5 years, but you started composing in movies in the mid-80s. Project.
Well, I think my first short movie was in 82 or 3. And the first feature was in 85 or 86, yes. Yep. Quite a long time ago already. I feel like an old man, especially with my broken voice from having a cold.
Okay.
I really sound like I'm 95, which I'm not.
Okay, you're still a relatively young man. How did you get into film composing?
It's a passion thing, you know. I was a cinephile and going to see movies all the time, and I started noticing the soundtracks and started collecting movie soundtracks. And of course, the rare things were not the French things, because you could find the French things. The rare things were the American things, mm-hmm. like the soundtracks of Waxman and Korngold and North. And I started to, you know, to try and find in flea markets and shops these rare records, like Taras Bulba or the Vikings or mm-hmm. Picnic, these kind of soundtracks. And I just realized how much there was an opportunity of writing good music and associate it to the other passion I had, which was cinema. That it worked, that you could really do something that would write something that would stand alone. I think that's what really brought me to movies, the passion of movies mixed with the passion of music.
Was it one score in a particular film, or is it one particular composer that you got hooked on that really got you really got into this?
I can remember many little streams that made a big river. For example, when I say many streams, little streams, I mean like listening to Bill Evans playing Spartacus Love theme by Alex North.
Mm-hmm.
You go, oh, I really have to get the score of that if I don't have this vinyl, the complete score of Spartacus. And then you go and you see Star Wars and you think, wow, there's so much there that is near from my classical education. Stravinsky, Prokofiev, Ravel, Debussy, all put into one brain, which is John Williams' incredible talent, and all these amazing melodies and so complex but still fine orchestrations. And you see the Hitchcock movies and you go, wow, the music is so strong and so important. It makes 75% of the movie. And the same with Fellini and Rota. So it's really many, many little streams that fed my big river of love for movie soundtracks.
What do you think of when you hear something almost minimalist by John Williams, like Jaws or Michel Legrand for, you know, Summer 42 or Love Story, where it's not, you know, the big orchestral and it's very minimalist? What do you think when you hear that?
I love it. I love it too. You know, on the many movies I've done in France,
mm-hmm.
and in England, many of them had no orchestra. There was a string quintet or a string quartet with a few players, or a jazz combo, and I've been trained in doing these kind of scores, actually, these minimal scores. And yes, Incidental Tourist might be one of the best scores of John Williams, but it's not a huge, thing. A huge sound, but just an intimate sound. And of course, Summer of 42, which is jazzy, is mm-hmm. fabulous. And one of my favorite scores by Bernard Herrmann is The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which
yes.
is the more intimate score that he wrote, possibly. And Taxi Driver. So I'm rather keen when and happy when the score can drift and blend with different influences. The other one I could name is Ascenseur pour l'Échafaud, music by Miles Davis for Louis Malle.
Right.
So there's many scores that I love and that really influenced me in this also very intimate level of sound. And again, that's one of the first things I said when I came to America, that in France we don't use many orchestras in the
mm-hmm.
scores. We don't want to have an orchestra intruding in a bedroom or in a cafe.
Well, I'm sure, you know, every composer has their own philosophy of what a score should do, whether it should accentuate or be counterpoint to a scene. What do you feel a score should do for a film?
I think it has to enhance the imagination, the hidden emotions. That's the way a score should work. because what we see on screen, we don't care. We see it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to underline it. I guess that's more European sensitivity. That what you see, you don't have to repeat. And I think actually that's what David Fincher wanted me to do also. Or Ang Lee or a few directors I've worked with, they want the score to have this quality of creating another dimension of imagination.
Well, and Fincher has said that he was a big fan of your great score for Birth. And
mm-hmm.
I'm curious, how did he describe what he wanted musically for Benjamin Button? What was his dictate, if you will, if he had one?
Well, you know, Birth, the dictate of the director of Birth, Jonathan Glazer, was, Alexandre, can you write a non-score? And I said, oh yeah, I'd love to. And that's what we tried really hard. A non-score being something that doesn't follow that does not repeat the action, but creates another dimension. And that's exactly what David wanted, that the music would create a world of emotion that we could share and have empathy with Benjamin Button, the character played by Brad Pitt,
mm-hmm.
And never, ever underline or accentuate the love story, but just make it more moving or more desperate or more sorrowful.
Mm-hmm.
Again, create another, I can't say better than that, just create another dimension, another depth of field.
Would it seem that Fincher, because, you know, he is a big music guy, whether he's used, you know, source music in his movies or with music videos and so forth, so it would seem that he really thinks in almost music terms. His movies have kind of, you could say, movements, if you will. And so I was wondering, was it an easy dialogue of between you and him on what he wanted for the film?
Very, very easy, because, as you say, he's trained, he's very experienced, and he's got a good taste, and he has, so when you play something that's not exactly right, he can very quickly analyze and understand why it's not in the right direction. They leave you freedom, but they expect you to surprise them and to reach a land that they've not explored, that they've not thought of, and that's what they want. They want you to be even more brave than they are. And that's, of course, it's a lot of pressure and a lot of anxiety and questioning, but it's the best way to stretch and find, again, to go to terra incognita.
I saw the film, and I was really struck when I was watching the movie that here was an epic. I mean, it's an epic film, and it spans decades. And yet the score, for a long time, is very delicate. Was that something Fincher said that needed it to be, or is that just the way when you saw the images, like, you know what, these images just need a little, you know, they need a light touch versus something, you know, big, if you will?
Well, it's all that together, yes, a light touch. Also, follow Benjamin Button,
mm-hmm.
which are his emotions. And he's a very laid-back character in the movie. He's not very active. You know, he's watching the world around him with a very kind perspective.
Mm-hmm.
He's very gentle and very... He's a man who likes to love the mankind. And the music couldn't be aggressive or arrogant. There's something that wouldn't match. So I think the music had to be... I thought the music had to be tender and very delicate. The other element is the sound of the movie, which is very full. Could it be because of the environment of music in New Orleans, but also because of voiceovers
mm-hmm.
that are there most of the time? Could it be his voiceover or old Kate Blanchett's voiceover, which is narrating the movie?
Mm-hmm.
So you had to. I just say like a little, like a snake, you know. The music had to go very, very, very in very minimal little holes and blossom a little bit and then hide again. And it's like going in a mysterious forest.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go loud. You can't go loud. You have to go, you know. You got to be very precise and delicate.
Is there one particular musical cue or sequence that you did where you're like, you know what, that's perfect of image and music coming together in the film, in Benjamin Button? Is there a sequence?
Well, it's hard for me to say that, because perfection is something that we will never reach.
Right.
I can think of moments that move me,
mm-hmm.
but it's the mix of everything, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the journey of the movie that makes at a twine point you're moved. I've seen actually people in the theater crying at moments that were not sad, but just because they had to release the emotion that had taken them for a few minutes on a previous scene.
Mm-hmm.
And on a funny scene, they would release the emotion and cry. It was very, very moving. I don't know. I like very much the opening, Mr. Gâteau, this Cocksmith character. I think there's something really magical there. And I like very much the love theme. I like when the two characters make love.
Mm-hmm.
When they meet, you know, when for the first time the two bodies get together.
Right.
And when they, many years later, they get together again. I like these two moments very much. I think that David made such a beautiful work there of
mm-hmm.
holding the emotion back to release it at the very, very moment where you can't hold your tears because it's so strong and so moving.
Right. Is there a difference of scoring in filming for European films versus American films?
I think things have changed a lot in the last 10 years, 15 years. I think film music is using new tools, not only the electronics, but I mean new tools that come from concert music. Could it be from the very contemporary composers, from Boulez to Stockhausen or John Cage, but also from the minimalists, Glass, Adams, Reich, and the way some composers in the 80s started to try different directions. in films, having not only a huge orchestra playing loud and following the action. If today we would write a Vertigo kind of score on a movie, it would be very weird. It would be rather inappropriate. So I think that the difference between European scores and American scores have shrunk a lot in that level. Now, in terms of budget, of course, American budgets are bigger, and the tradition also is more into having a larger sound of the score. But aside from that, I think the directors are more, at least from my generation, between 35 and 45, they have this sensitivity, and this aesthetic, which is more about creating what I said before, another world, and not just following the action. And then you can find directors like this in America, like Fincher, or in England, like Jonathan Glazer, or Peter Weber, or in France, like Jacques Audiard, who's the best French director. They share the same desire of a score that would create another world.
You've gotten a lot of critical citations, and you did get nominated for The Queen, and you've been nominated, I believe, for Golden Globe for Benjamin Button. So what would a nomination mean, again, for Benjamin Button?
Well, you know, the Oscars is the top of the tops of the actors, of all the technical, below-the-line people, and of course the best of the composers, the best of everything. Mm-hmm. So to be part of that bunch is a tremendous reward. To be honored by, or heard as a musician by your peers, it's a strong emotion. And also because the history of the Oscars shows the names of the composers that I have admired, from Maurice Jarre, Georges Delerue, Michel Legrand, Francis Lay for the French, Gabriel Yared, of course, and for the last years, and all the American composers, Herman, Williams, Goldsmith, Emma Bernstein. So to be suddenly part of that list is a dream, is a childhood dream. So it would be marvelous to be nominated again. I would be more than honored and happy. It's marvelous.
Well, I want to ask you about two projects that are in the works, and I'm curious what the status of one of them. But I've talked to production designer Jack Fisk about the film, and I got to ask about Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life, and I'm wondering what those spotting sessions are like, because, you know, Malick is notorious for going through many edits of the film, be it longer or shorter, and really, you know, going back and forth. So have you started on that, or what's the status of that?
I can't really comment on that. The only thing I can't really comment on that. The only comment I can give is that Terrence Malick is not looking for a movie score.
Okay.
He's looking for music, and he's just seeking for the music that will fit, and that will give the rhythm and the emotion that he's seeking for. Mm-hmm. The rest is not important. Should it start here? Should it start there? I think that's the least of his issues, concerns. That's all I can say so far.
Well, I look forward to that. And then the other film, which I assume, because it's directed by Nora Ephron, it might be a real change of pace, but Julie and Julia, how's that score? What's that score like, working with Nora Ephron?
Well, Nora is a very precise writer. So, of course, when the music comes to the picture, it's got to be very, very precise, as any comedy should be, because the pace, as you know, is crucial. The precision of every single entry of music is crucial. It brings me back to my European or French training, because I've done a few comedies, of course, in France and in England, where you learn where to, you know, to find the right balance between not being goofy and still being light. I think it's very difficult to write the score of a comedy. Very, very difficult, because you always are on a thin thread that can easily put you down if you go too funny, too, you know, it becomes very cheesy, and it kills the movie. So, in terms of orchestration, the movie is set mostly in France in the 50s. So I've used my ability to mix jazz guitar, and jazz piano, and accordion, and write waltzes for strings, and you know, this kind of.
I would think that the film would be kind of exciting in that it would be the best of both worlds, in that here's an American film, but it's a comedy, but then it's set in the 50s and in France, and so you get to draw on that history, and you really get to it gives you an opportunity to kind of mix and match a lot of stuff that has influenced you up to this point.
Yeah, well, it was really a lot of fun to do. As you say, using all my tools, all my colors, because I've got many tools in my bag that I've tried through the years, and I've tried on this one to mix some of them and put them together in a new order. And I think Nora was very happy. I think it works very well, and the movie is really, really funny. Meryl Streep is fantastic, and Amy Adams is really sweet, and it's a great movie. It's a beautiful movie. It's moving. Funny enough, it's a moving movie, and very emotional, and still very, very funny, like Nora Ephron knows to do.
Well, I look forward to it. I got to ask real quick, just because I'm a major music fan and critic, also along with being a film critic, and that you're you said you were calling from Abbey Road Studios. So what's it like being, you know, I'm sure you've been to all kinds of studios and all over the world, but what's it like being in that studio with that history, the Abbey Road Studio? That's pretty amazing.
Well, Abbey Road Studios, when you look on the walls, you see pictures of all the great conductors, Carl Jung and Daniel Barenboim playing with Jacqueline Dupré, and you know that John Williams is the ghost of in these walls, and a photo of Shirley Bassey in the 60s in a pink dress. you know, it's a historical building. It's like going to a museum. You're in a kind of a temple here. So you try to learn a lot and behave and be the best as you can, because these people are looking at you from from every corner of the corridor.
Thank you.
Isham was awarded the Composer of the Year honor at the annual Hollywood Film Festival. The award was well-deserved, if only for the astounding fact that Isham's creative output for 2007 includes unforgettable scores for a whopping 7 feature films, including Freedom Riders, Gracie, Next, Lions for Lambs, and the Valley of Ella, Reservation Road, Frank Darabont's upcoming film The Mist, and that's not even counting his work for the entire first season of Paul Haggis's The Black Donnellys television series. In fact, upon review of Mr. Isham's remarkable resume, it's hard not to categorize him as the composer of the past quarter century, having meticulously crafted a series of extraordinary scores for films as diverse as The Hitcher, Romeo is Bleeding, Blade, Night Falls in Manhattan, Quiz Show, Rules of Engagement, Crash, The Black Dahlia, In Her Shoes, and A River Runs Through It, for which he earned an Academy Award nomination. It is a tremendous honor for all of us here at Movie Geeks United to welcome to the show Mr. Mark Isham. Mr. Isham, are you with us?
I am. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much for being with us. It's a great treat to speak with you tonight.
Oh, well, likewise. A great treat to be here.
How about this career? No doubt you've had an exceptional career, but
it's been going pretty well. Yeah.
This year seems to just be crazy for you. Your 7 projects and
this last year has been a pretty exceptional year, and especially the quality and the new relationships, old relationships have come around to be, Paul Haggis making a new film, Robert Redford making a film. I mean, these are pretty extraordinary opportunities for me. I'm just glad to be here and have the opportunity to join them.
Yeah, and you've worked with both several times, and talk about great collaborators to have on your side. I mean, that's as good as it gets.
Well, it is. I mean, I was been thinking about that recently, that really one of the great joys of this profession is that collaboration. I mean, filmmaking, I think, is the true collaborative art form, and but it always needs a great captain, to captain that ship. And
yeah,
I've been very, very fortunate in my career to work with some of the best. I mean, you mentioned Brian De Palma. I mean, I did The Black Dahlia for him a year ago, and it's going well.
Well, I would definitely want to ask you about all of these high-profile collaborations and your process, but tell us a little bit about how your musical education began.
Well, I was very fortunate. I was born into a family that was very musical. My mother is still a professional violinist up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my father is a professor of history and the humanities. So I was a lot of music around the house. And at a young age, my mother would drag me into a lot of orchestra rehearsals, and I discovered the trumpet. I thought it was the coolest instrument in the orchestra, loud, bold, I thought that was for me, so I became a trumpet player and worked professionally, and of course still have a trumpet playing career that I managed to hold on to. If the film work does lets up occasionally, and I just loved music, all sorts of genres. I have a background in classical music, but I discovered jazz at a very early age, and I also discovered electronic music actually at a very early age, and sort of those three elements, I just continued to sort of bounce around and explore through my 20s, and included, of course, playing in more pop rock bands just to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I reached my late 20s, early 30s, I had probably, a pretty impressive education in music, more or less just by doing it and being involved in it.
Right.
And at that time, the timing was really good because a film director, Mr. Carroll Ballard, heard a piece of music that I had written and said, that's what I've been looking for. I didn't know how to describe it, but that's it. That's what this film needs. And he tracked me down and offered me the opportunity to score Never Cry Wolf.
Never Cry Wolf, exactly, yeah.
And, I had no training in film music whatsoever, but I realized this was a tremendous opportunity, and I should grab it, and I should do everything I possibly can to complete it.
So had you given any thought previous to that about film composing?
Not really. I think at one time a dance company had approached me, and I'd written one piece for a dance company. And so I knew that there was professions out there that one could do that, where you wrote music to accompany image. And obviously I went to movies, and I knew that I was a fan of Henry Mancini and and John Williams, and I knew the big names, but for some reason it's never been a career choice for me until it was sort of thrust at me.
Yeah.
And then I just said, well, why not? Let me just try it. And it was a remarkable experience. I found that, I think just to find that somebody wants you to compose instrumental music and wants to pay to have it recorded well was such a, such a unique experience. You know, that I said, well, this is quite something. Maybe I should look into this. And,
yeah.
And the rest sort of was history.
Well, the process just fascinates me. And I want you to take me through the process of, as best you can, of scoring a picture. And let's take, if you don't mind, Lions for Lambs, which I've had on repeat. I said at the beginning of the show, I'm going to wear the CD out because I'm in love with the score. So you sit down and you watch the picture and you get first impressions. Tell me what starts to come together for you when you try to find a musical voice for that film.
Well, Lions for Lambs, it was quite interesting. I met with Bob and actually went to the set when he was still shooting the last parts of the movie. And so I had a chance to get a sense of what he was doing there and met with him for a couple of hours afterwards and heard, you know, what he was looking for. And the meeting must have gone well and reaffirmed that... you know, that we worked well together because he hired me immediately after that. And then he said, look, let me get some rough assembly done and then we should talk further.
Right.
And I went up to his place in Northern California about a month or so later, and he had about 5 scenes assembled. And he said, look, we put some music in here and I think you should hear it because it's not what I was expecting. And he was right, because it was not what I was expecting either. I thought when I read the script that this would be not too dissimilar to Valley of Ella or Crash. You know, it was intimate piece. There were no more than 2 or 3 people in a room at the same time. Even the more action-oriented stuff is just 2 guys and they're stuck. They're not moving. Nothing. You know, not a lot of things are happening viscerally in the script. And yet somehow the way that Joe Hutching was cutting it together, it had tremendous momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And they had put some very, very rhythmic music in the front of the picture, and I just looked at Bob and said, you know, all my intellectual instincts would have said that would be wrong, but it's great. It's just great. It does a lot for this movie. And we both agreed right from there that the score was going to be bigger and more just different, you know, very different than any sort of initial analysis from the script would yield you to believe.
Yeah. It seems to be very similar to Crash in the movie itself, in that it's a movie of ideas and these kind of interweaving stories.
Well, exactly, and the score for Crash is quite delicate.
Yeah,
and sort of floats above the movie.
Yeah,
and which was perfect for that movie, and one which, you know, we came to with a little experimentation, and it became very clear to Paul and I after not much experimentation that was really the most effective way to do it. This film is the exact opposite. I mean, we charge into this thing as if it's a Tony Scott thriller.
Exactly, yeah.
And it works. And then I must say the score just does change gears. But what's interesting about the structure of this score is that it changes gears gradually. After the first reel and a half, those harder-edged electronic sounds start to gradually, you know, every cue they're a little less.
Mm.
And every cue, the orchestra starts to take more of a major role.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time you get to the last reel and a half, the orchestra has really stepped up, and you really feel a large, organic, very emotional presence, emotional,
yeah,
in a very traditional way. And by the last, you know, the penultimate scene, electronics, for all intents and purposes, faded out. The full orchestra has stepped forth. There's a woman's choir has arrived, and we have a very, you know, intensely emotional ending. It done in the sense of using a large orchestra for that in a traditional way, although the music itself, I think, is definitely not traditional.
Yeah, it's a fantastic piece of work. Now, you mentioned that they used a temp score. What's your perspective on the use of temp scores? Is it helpful? Do you kind of resent it because you can't start with a blank slate?
I don't resent it. I find more often than not that they do have some help, even for me. Occasionally they can become problematic, and because I do I've been doing this for a little while now. I've sort of got some tricks up my sleeve of how to solve the problems of temp love, for instance. You know,
right.
A director or filmmaking team who've just fallen in love with an earlier piece of music and can't get it out of their mind that this is the only way to do it. So barring you know, things like that, it's actually quite helpful because it is very difficult to verbalize music.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that you know, all the talking in the world sometimes can't really explain the sensation that you're getting from a particular piece of music in a particular place that you couldn't begin to explain to somebody how, you know, what that is. And it's just much easier to play. You see the interaction here, and then I can analyze that and figure out, well, what are the elements that are creating this effect, and then I can ditch the specifics and use the general ideas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, there is something wonderful about diving into a picture which you've never seen any music except something that you create for it originally. But once again, I think I've out of experience, I can sort of recreate that for myself. I can take a day off from writing, and then I come back and just look at the picture with no music, and pretty much sort of mock up that effect again for myself if I want to do that.
Yeah. Well, you currently have two other projects that are in theaters and in stores as well, and that's in the Valley of Ella and Reservation Road. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when you're composing these pictures, I mean, I'm sure that you almost have to find yourself living in the picture in a sense.
It's very true, and that's an interesting way of describing it. I think that's pretty spot on. I was trying to describe it the other day, actually, and described it similarly in that you want to get into that universe. You know, a good filmmaker creates a very specific universe that story is unfolding in, and that's why it's very important for me to start writing once I have a picture. I find it very difficult to write from just a script.
Yeah,
I like to see the fabric of this universe. The colors of it, you know, the size of it. Is it shot so that everything seems very constricted and tight and small and introverted? Or is it shot so it's wide open and things seem limitless? I mean, those are very important sensations to take into account for music. I mean, space is a big element that music can contribute to,
mm-hmm.
and needs to be a part of in a correct balance. So, yeah, it's that image, and as you say, it's living that life that the story is telling, being in that universe. I throw myself into it, and once the musical universe is defined, then it starts to flow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can write, you know, sad music or happy music or reconciliatory music or whatever it needs to be in that vocabulary of that universe.
Yeah. Do you find too that the best directors are the ones with the strongest musical sense?
It doesn't have to be specifically musical sense, but it has to be a real sense of emotion and how it works, and not a contrived sense of how it works, but a real ability to have looked at life and see how it really works, you know. And one of the great things about working with Bob Redford is that he is such a fine actor, and he really can look at a character and a character's experience in a storytelling and describe that arc as to what's happened, you know, what's happened before, what's happening precisely at these moments, and where are we headed, and where's that character, you know, the evolution, emotional evolution of this character. And I find someone who can articulate those things well and pinpoint, you know, the points in the story that connect and the way that the emotions transfer from one character to another, or one scene to another, and all these fine points of a story, if they can just communicate that to me, I can translate it into music.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, sometimes it's better that they don't try and do it, that they just leave that to me. So I find, and Haggis is the same way. He's such a great writer that he can look at and feel, you know, and be very precise. You know, at this moment, Mark, even though, you know, things are exploding, what's happening in this person's head is this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the music, I want the music inside their head, so I need you to do this. And insight into it like that is what's really the most valuable.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about Redford and Haggis, and you've already spoken to them. But let me ask you about a couple of the other collaborators, directors that you've worked with. I know Frank Darabont. You've composed for him a couple of times, and the latest is with The Myth.
Yeah.
And what a treat was that to score essentially a great monster movie.
Well, it is, you know, and it's really a first time that I've done a real just no holds barred monster movie.
Yeah.
And Frank, you know, is very upfront about that in talking about the film himself. He says, you know, this it's a low budget horror film, kids, and we're having the time of our life. Of course, the truth of the matter is that, you know, Frank is just one of the all-time great writers and directors, and in his hands, you know, a very simple horror story, although, you know, masterfully told, of course, by one of the great master horror storytellers.
Right.
But turned into a film, again, by a real master, it rises way above that genre and becomes really quite something extraordinary. And, I mean, Frank is again, one of... very, very similar in that way that he loves music, he respects music tremendously. He'll leave the translation to me, and mm-hmm. but he is so tuned into his storytelling and so tuned into exactly where things change and how characters, you know, their internal struggles versus their external struggles and how all of this ties together and where things, you know, should bend and twist and that. You know, he's a great navigator through those things and can point out all the spots that need to be pointed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can definitely see that in his work, what a master storyteller he is.
Oh, just one of the finest.
And of course, we mentioned it a little earlier, but I have to ask you about your experience with De Palma on the Black Dahlia, because you talk about just a visual artist. I mean, his films are just visual feasts that must be incredible to compose to those.
Yes, yeah. I mean, working with De Palma was really tremendous, because he's actually quite very different from, you know, some of these other directors. He is, in a sense, very... Well, you see it in his filmmaking style. He's very sort of black and white. You know, things are big. Gestures are big. It's like, bam, bam. Okay, now we're here. No, now we're here. And now we're doing this, and now we're doing this. And then just when you thought we were going to do this, no, we're going to do the exact opposite. And therefore, it's sort of liberating score-wise, because you can follow him in those big gestures.
Yeah.
And, you know, things that I would never do in a Paul Haggis or a Terry George movie, you know, you can just do with wild abandon in a Brian De Palma movie. And, in fact, you know, I had to push myself to be bigger and bolder and even more extravagant. And but then also the level of detail that he has in his image. I found that orchestrationally was really inspired me, I really wanted to find an orchestral vocabulary that was unique and very, how should I say this, emotionally raw, but at the same time very sophisticated in its structure. And so there was a lot of Leonard Bernstein influence, and just, I had a blast on that score.
Well, you get to, it utilizes the trumpet.
Well, yes, I hired somebody I know pretty well to play the trumpet and convinced him he had to practice.
it reminded me, not that the score sounds like it, but because of the time period of the film and the use of the trumpet, I thought back on Chinatown, the crew.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought about that myself and said, well, what the hell, I'm going to brave it.
So tell me how the computer has changed what you do, that technology.
Well, it makes a certain part of the score writing process quicker. Certainly access to a wide variety of sounds when you're demoing for yourself and then demoing for the filmmakers. You know, you have basically at your fingertips, if you go spend a couple of days designing things and organizing things well, pretty much anything you can imagine. Which, of course, is very different than 10, 15 years ago when it would take, you know, days to put together a studio that could create demos of that sophistication.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a tremendous boon, and it really helps the demo process. It really helps inspiring confidence in the filmmakers that you're on the right track. They can hear, with very little exception, I think, almost a fully realized mock-up of a score that doesn't leave a lot to the imagination. And this, of course, is very good for nervous filmmakers and nervous producers and nervous studios, and especially if you're spending a lot of their money. They're very happy about that, and I'm happy too, because then the recording sessions are much more relaxed.
Yeah.
So I think in general the process is and the technology that we have is good for the process. The one thing that I have to constantly remind myself, though, is to not get lulled into that the instruments that you're writing for are so much more capable than the fake versions that I have in the studio.
Right.
And not to forget that the orchestra is capable of a lot more, and to know that there's a part two to the writing, that I can write something, present it as a demo, know that they love it, but know that after that then that I really have to push myself and the orchestrators to let the final score rise as high above that as possible, and not just get sort of stuck in the electronic world.
Yeah. And I had a question for you that I always tend to ask one question that's just off the wall and embarrasses me, but this might be one of them. I've heard actors say that when they read a scene, there's often an obvious way to play the scene, but when they try to play it the exact opposite way, it kind of makes it more interesting and it kind of brings out a deeper truth to the moment. As a composer, are you looking for ways to avoid the obvious musical cliches and can you give me an example of an instance where you did this, kind of created a musical counterpoint, I guess you'd say?
The basic answer to that question is yes. I mean, I am always looking for a different way of doing it. I'm trying to think of some. I mean, obviously, I remember there was one point in a. I don't remember if I actually remember the film, but. This has been a way that other directors have done it, the not obvious way too. But you know, like a heavy war scene, for instance, all of a sudden the battle sounds and the heavy action music fade out, and you might just have a choir singing a very
simple
hymn, right? Things like that can be incredibly powerful. I remember Oliver Stone, I think, does something like that in one of his earlier movies, and I did that at one point in some, I can't remember exactly. But there are moments in Valley of Elah like that where, you know, Paul wanted just sort of things to fall away. And, of course, the ending of Lions for Lambs. I can't say that we got small, But there is a moment, the penultimate moment in Lines for Lambs.
Yeah.
People hadn't seen it, I won't give it away, but there's a scene where what you're looking at visually is just tremendously loud. I mean, just like would be breaking your eardrums, and the sound just drifts away into nothingness, and the orchestra just is playing.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous moment.
Yeah, moments like that are priceless for a composer, especially when the director says, you know, that's what I think I'm going to do here. You say, oh boy, this is now it's all up to me.
Yeah.
And a little unnerving at first, but what a challenge and what an opportunity, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I have a question.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you work with Alan Rudolph a lot in the past, and I'm just curious, what is it like to work with him?
Well, Alan was my first sort of, long-term relationship. My third film was an Alan Rudolph film, and he was just sort of getting on a roll. As a young director, he'd just come out of working a lot with Barbara.
Actually, that's one of my favorites, Trouble in Mind.
That was the first one that I did, yeah.
I love that film.
Oh, thank
great
you.
Film.
Well, see, I'd gone to see Choose Me.
That's another one.
Which was, I think, his first breakout movie on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Not his first movie, but the first one that really...
The first one that got everyone's attention.
Exactly. And it got my attention. I came back and said to my agent, I saw this movie over the weekend. I want to work with this guy. And strangely enough, Alan had just turned a record of mine and had phoned his producer and said, does this guy write film score? So it was, and that's the way our relationship was for, I don't know, God, 10, 11 films I think we've done.
Mm.
Just very, we think alike. He is one of the most improvisational film directors that I've ever worked with.
I think it's always an event when a film of his, you know, comes out. I mean, he's a very unique director.
Yeah. And we just hit it off right from the beginning. You know, he'd be one of the ones that would be willing for me just to hire a band and then, you know, write a few tunes and then let them sort of improvise these tunes as a score. You know, he would love ideas like that.
Great.
Because he would do scenes like that. He would say, this is a scene I don't want to know exactly how this is going to go. I just want to tell the characters that this is what they got to come out of this room having achieved this and just let them do it. You know?
Yeah.
Cool.
That's brave. Filming
that is.
Like that is very, and it's harder and harder to do. In fact, I don't know if anybody can get away with it anymore. But, you know, it was a remarkable experience working with someone like that who's willing to think like that and willing to, you know, let you create a score like that. Also.
Right.
Mr. Isham, we have a question for you from our chat room from a listener by the name of Neo.
Okay.
And first of all, he wants to make it clear he believes that you are a genius and he's very giddy just listening to you.
I think Neo's a she, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. Neo says, and I hope I read this question correctly, have you considered collaborating with George Winston again?
Actually, that hasn't come up. No. In fact, I'm not quite sure where George is these days. I know that... you know, he founded his record label and got very involved in that, and I hadn't heard that he'd actually been playing much anymore. I could be completely wrong. I'm just sort of out of touch with George's life and don't really know.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, and Neo is a she. I'm so sorry. I've apologized to her on the chat room. Is there a community among film composers? Do you communicate often with each other or follow each other's work?
Well, I think we follow each other's work. I mean, I certainly know that I look at other film composers' work. I like to see them sort of see, because, you know, like any profession that's evolving, I mean, it is evolving, and there are trends and styles and things that are considered the way to do things for a while, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, oh, we don't do that anymore, you know.
Right.
But it's actually a pretty lonely profession in the sense that the real nuts and bolts work of it are done by yourself in a room, usually late at night, and the quieter the better. So we don't really get a chance to hang out with each other a lot because there's very, very seldom are there more than one composer on a film. And even if there are, you're probably writing by yourselves and then, you know, show and tell what you're showing and telling what you've done to each other.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it when I do have a chance. I remember the first time that I met Hans Zimmer. I said, well, we need to have lunch, and we've managed to have two lunches, I think, in 10 years, but we really do enjoy it when we do. And I finally met Michael Dana and Rolf Kent the other night, which was really a blast because it was great to meet them because they're very unique and wonderful composers.
I know that when we spoke to Howard Shore, he talked about he's going into opera. He's done an opera for The Fly, and I was wondering, is there something that you're dying to do, a dream that has not yet been fulfilled?
Well, I still, my dreams are still in the trumpet playing side of the world and the performing side. I still find that having a band that is a close-knit band where we understand each other well musically and that we have the same sort of goals to create sort of a conversational, improvisational music in front of an audience. Because I've had these bands before.
Yeah.
And when they're at the top of their game and you on tour and doing a series of, you know, great venues playing music like this, there's really nothing else better as far as I'm concerned. But the sensation of putting yourself out there on this sort of creative tightrope, you know, of not having it, you know, predetermined and exactly rehearsed down to the 16th note, knowing that you're going out to create this stuff totally fresh and virtually brand new, but that you trust the people that you're with and you're willing to go out in front of, you know, thousands of people and do this, and then pulling it off, there's really very little like that for me.
Yeah, there's nothing like the thrill of live performance. Yeah,
yeah. And so I still... You know, one of the reasons I'm a father now of four children, so film composing is a great, you know, creative outlet for me, and it's a nice job, and it keeps me home with my children. I think as the children grow up, I will probably try to, you know, shift the balance again of my career back to more performing, because, and that's probably my dream.
Yeah,
I would have to say because, one of the things that I have experimented with is bringing film and the larger ensembles into that. I've done some evenings of with orchestras where we project film, and yet there's still this sort of improvisational core, and that's really exciting. So, although I can't really articulate a specific dream, it's probably along those lines to really work. And I can see why Howard, you know, get back into the concert hall, you know, get back into the live music. It's so vital and so. So much fun for everybody. The audience certainly has a great time.
Oh, yeah. It must be a thrill. Mr. Isham, you've been so nice to us, giving us so much time tonight. Can I accept one call for you, and then we'll wrap things up?
Certainly.
860 area code. Go right ahead.
Oh, my name is Tony Harrington. I've been following you for years. Isham, I'm surprised you have an... did a conceptual album like Vapor Drawing. There's a new age side of you that's how I discovered you. Have you ever thought about doing something like that again?
It crosses my mind, yeah. I'm actually working on two albums right now, whenever I manage to find a spare weekend or something from the film work.
It's hard with seven films a year.
Yeah, it is very, very hard. And I've, you know, three sons in school that playing sports, and there's games to go to. I mean,
oh wow,
there's a lot to do here. But I've expressed my love for live music, and part of being able to get out there and accept live concerts is having an album out there. It sort of creates the momentum for booking tours and concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So the albums are important. I can't say that a specific sort of new age record is in the offing. I am working on an album of jazz standards, but put into a very different settings, almost settings where you can't really tell what the original song was at first.
Huh.
And it sort of unfolds like a surprise package. And it is very electronic. Basically, at this point, it's just trumpet with electronics only. And then there's a few guest artists. You know, I have Sid Page comes and plays violin, and I'm planned a few others. So I can't say it's stylistically new age, but it is trumpet and electronics. It does have that similarity. And then there's an original composition album underway too that's a little more sort of acid jazzy, remix, you know, a little more groove oriented.
Oh wow, can't wait. Yeah. When do those come out?
Well, really, you know, when I find the time. At this point, we're not going to make it this year. I wanted to try and at least get one of them out this year. It doesn't look like I'll but I hope to get the albums done this year and both out next year for sure.
And on the film composing front, what do you have upcoming?
Currently, I'm working on a wonderful film, a Dennis Quaid film directed by Gary Flader, the story of Ernie Davis, the first black Heisman Trophy winner.
Hmm.
Oh, that should be good.
Which I'm actually sort of constantly on the lookout for football movies because I have two sons who both play football. One at a very, very high level, so it's almost like a family thing. You know, Dad can score a football movie, then it's involved, you know.
Well,
so that thus you see, you know, a fair number of football movies scattered over the last couple of years also.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we look forward to all of that. Mr. Isham, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you, and please come back to us anytime you want in the future.
Well, I very much enjoy that. It's been a great pleasure for me, too.
Our next guest is one of the most talented and versatile composers working in film. This legendary talent began his career as the founder of the group Lighthouse before joining Saturday Night Live as their first musical director between 1975 and 1980. He soon fell into a collaboration with director David Cronenberg, a relationship that still thrives after 12 films together. His uniquely expressive and unforgettable work can be heard in films as diverse as The Fly, Ed Wood, Silence of the Lambs, The Departed, Mrs. Doubtfire, and of course, Peter Jackson's epic Lord of the Rings trilogy, which is a remarkable work, breathtaking both in its scope and pure emotional power. His work is beloved by fans across the globe, and critics, groups, and awards organizations agree. His long list of honors include 11 ASCAP Awards, 2 Saturn Awards, 3 Golden Globes, 4 Grammys, a Career Achievement Award from the National Board of Review, and 3 Oscars for his work on the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And this amazingly talented musician doesn't slow down for a second. His new score for David Cronenberg's latest film, Eastern Promises, is in stores now. The Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra will be performing his Lord of the Rings symphony this coming weekend, and the complete recordings of his score for Return of the King will be released on November 6th. It is a tremendous honor to to welcome to our show Mr. Howard Shore. Let me see if I can bring this line up. Mr. Shore, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Shore, thank you so much for joining us tonight and taking time out of your schedule to be with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to start, when did you know that music would be your life?
I started studying quite young, when I was 8 and 9, and I was studying harmony and counterpoint, and started to play music with other musicians, and then I met other writers,
mm-hmm.
and friends of mine who then became directors, and some became actors, and that group as a kid, in the teens, was really important to me because some of those friendships were very long-lasting, and I did a little directing, I did some acting, and then I just decided around 17 to pursue music, and music was the thing I was really interested in.
So you started bands, you started Lighthouse in the 70s?
I started bands when I was 14, right?
Mm.
13, 14. Lighthouse started... I think about 1969, and I was one of the founding members of that group, and I toured with the group for 4 years. I did, I think, about 1,000 one-nighters between 69 and 72, and I was quite young, so I got to see a lot of the world, and we toured with Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane,
oh, goodness.
Big Brother and the Holding Company. It was an interesting period.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
So how did the job at Saturday Night Live come about for you?
Well, Lorne is a few years older than I am, but we met at a summer camp in Northern Ontario when we were kids. I was 13 when I met Lorne, and we became good friends. And when we started writing together, and we did a show actually in Northern Ontario in summer camp at a camp called Timberland that was like a sketch comedy show. It was the early genesis of Saturday Night Live. This is now about 1960, 61, and we do it a show once a week at this co-ed camp on Saturday night, and that was really the start of our collaboration. And then we met Danny Aykroyd and Gilda Radner in Toronto and Second City people, and Lorne went to California. I went on the road. He was working with Lily Tomlin and Flip Wilson, and we met in New York, back in New York at 1975, again with a group of friends, and started the show. There was probably about maybe 15 of us, 12 or 15 writers, performers, musicians, directors, that kind of thing.
Just an amazing, just a breathtaking assemble of just tremendous talents that converge for Saturday Night Live at the beginning.
It was an interesting time. I mean, people came from California, from Chicago, mostly from Second City. Belushi was from Chicago, and then Bill Murray came from Chicago. Gilda from Detroit. Danny Aykroyd was in Toronto. So, you know, so a group of us came. We came from all over. Some people were in New York. Ann Beats, Michael O'Donoghue in New York. Cheryl Hardwick was in New York.
You were also instrumental in the formation of the Blues Brothers, is that correct?
Well, the Blues Brothers were, it was an opening act for the show. When we did the warm-up
mm-hmm.
on Saturday night for the dress rehearsal and for the live audience, we do a warm-up with the band. And it was very open, it was very free, and we do improvisations, and we'd play a lot of blues stuff and R&B stuff that I love from that period, from the Sax catalog, and I was writing R&B tunes and writing the theme to the show, which was very Junior Walker inspired, and so the blues was part of the creation of the show. I mean, it was what we were interested in, and so Danny would join in and play a little harp with us in the beginning, you know, just warming up. It was a very loose kind of thing. And then John wanted to join in and be part of it, and I would introduce them as those brothers in blues, the Blues Brothers. I don't know where it came from, but I would just introduce them as that, and then that sort of stuck, and it kind of went on from there.
What kind of tools did you take away from your SNL experience?
Well, it was a good collaborative period. It was a great way to work with writers very, very carefully, very closely. It was a good way to work with performers. You got to work with different directors. The hosts were there every week, a variety of hosts, really interesting, fascinating people from all areas of the world. There were writers, performers. You learned a lot. I mean, I was in my 20s. It was a way to really do repertory theater for television. It was like, you know, a group activity that expressed itself in a weekly show. You know, Saturday at 11:30 was a culmination of our work that week.
Yeah.
And the early years of the show, there really was no form to it. Now, when you watch Saturday Live, you know what it is, and you know when update comes, and you know it has this structure to it. But in the beginning, it was very free form, and if you watch those early shows, it was us just trying to come up with enough ideas in music and comedy, you know, to really do 90 minutes of good television a week.
Yeah. It's a tremendous challenge, I'm sure. During this time, did David Cronenberg approach you? How did that relationship begin?
No, as I mentioned earlier, I've been writing and, you know, I've been studying music since I was a kid and writing, and really didn't have the means to realize the things that I was hearing in my mind. I was only able to work with, you know, small groups, chamber groups, brass trios, you know, whatever I could get together to write for. And writing for the band on the show was okay, you know, for the period. It was exciting for a year or two, but it was limited in a way to what I was wanting to do with music and the things that I was imagining. So I thought movies were very experimental to me, because I came of age kind of in the 50s and the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So movies always, film music to me was a way to really try really kind of different things. It was a way to experiment and do things. And so I kind of looked to that. And around 78, I did a film in Canada, a thriller. It's actually a murder mystery film with Elka Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then David knew about that. And then I think when he was doing The Brood in 1978, I think it was around the same period, I asked him, I approached him if he was interested in having an original score for his films, because he had always did his films with needle drop, didn't have the budget to hire a composer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cronenberg, David's been making movies since he was 16, 8mm movies. And then 16mm, and then 35. So around the time of The Brood, 78, he felt he was maybe ready to try it. And he knew me. I was younger than David, and he's a few years older than I am. I think about 3 or 4 years older. So when you're kids, I mean, when I was 12, David was 16. And you'd see him in the neighborhood, and he had this beautiful Italian motorcycle, and he had great hair and clothes, and he had a page boy haircut from the 60s, you know.
Yeah.
And he just looked amazing. And you would see him around the neighborhood, and you didn't know who he was. And when you were 12, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
Sight, you know. And then I found out that he made films, and I would see his films in underground film festivals, which were popular in the 60s. And you'd go at midnight, and you'd see, you know, films till like 2, 3 in the morning at these underground festivals. And most, a lot of short films, 30-minute films, one-reeler type things. And I saw some of his short films, and so I became interested in what he was doing. And then again around the time of The Brood, 78, I approached him to see if he was interested in work collaboration. And he said yes, he was, and so we started working together.
And talk about a collaboration that just endured and thrived so well throughout the years. Tell me about that working relationship. What makes the two of you gel so well together?
I think just, you know, that we're from a very similar background. We both grew up in Toronto and a similar neighborhood. A lot of our friends now are people that we knew when we were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And David says I introduced him to his wife, Carolyn, that he's been married to for a long time. I don't know how long, but quite a long time. So I think there's just this like sensibility, you know, in the way we look at things, the way we look at films, the way David is the most well-read person I know. And I think his age, maybe that fact that he's a few years older than me, always seemed like a bit of an older brother, and I was sort of
mm-hmm.
looking up to him because he always knew much more than I did, and I was always learning things from him all the time. And I still feel that way. I still feel that every time he takes on a new project, there's a learning curve because you're catching up to Cronenberg. Never really, you don't really know enough. I mean, you know, Eastern Promises is interesting because he did a celebrity list in Amazon of books that he had studied for the film, and
mm-hmm.
he listed the top 10 books that were all about, you know, Russian politics, Russian philosophy, Russian criminal activity. I mean, amazing books. And I thought, you know, it's so incredible. I mean, he's interested in so many things, and he's so well-read, it's a constant learning. And I think that's an inspiring thing because the group has stayed together for a long time, almost 30 years, making these films.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always constantly growing, and, you know, we're learning new things, and we're expressing new ideas. And also, when you have a group like that works together, there's no way to go back. You're constantly going forward because
yeah.
you've done all this work. And so you can't revert to something you've done. Nobody gets away with anything, you see, because everybody knows everything about everybody.
Yeah, it's like a family.
Yeah, so you've got to constantly be on your toes and be doing your best work.
So let's talk about Eastern Promises for a little bit. I'm interested in the process of crafting a musical voice for these films.
Mm-hmm.
So taking Eastern Promises, what did you have to understand about the themes of the film, or what were your considerations before you started to craft that theme?
Well, David always sends me either the books that he's interested in or books that he's adapting very early on. I mean, he sends these scripts to me really early when he's just starting to think about it, and even before he's cast the film. So you start clicking away on things that he's thinking about. I mean, Eastern Promises, it involved a lot of research of Russian folk music. We listened to a lot of music together. You know, we would do the research in the libraries, and then we would pass the music back and forth to each other. So we were constantly listening to a lot of music, and he was listening to a lot of music when he was shooting. And I always go to visit him when he's shooting. I always go to the set. I meet the actors. Of course, I know Viggo from Lord of the Rings and from History of Violence. And so it's great to see him. And, you know, and also Peter Shusitsky, the great cinematographer who shot Dead Ringers and all the movies in between, is incredible. And so Ron Sanders is there during the shoot, who has been editing David's films for years, a fantastic editor. And so, you're going and being part of this group, Carol Spear, the production designer, and you're soaking up atmosphere from the set, from the script, from David. Watching David shoot is a really interesting experience, and really, it's really thought-provoking when you watch how he shoots and the things that he selects and where he moves the camera and where
mm-hmm.
he puts the camera. It's really interesting. And so all of those things, I think you go away from that with ideas and you start to assemble a body of work just based on the idea of the film. We also looked at Russian criminal tattoos. There's a wonderful documentary Alex Lambert did. Went into a high-security Russian prison and shot criminals with shot their tattoos, basically. And it's a documentary on what the tattoos mean, the hierarchy of the criminals in prison, and how all of their history is expressed on their body. You can tell in prison just by looking at a man's tattoos what he's done, how many murders he's done, how many felonies, how many robberies. Tells you everything about him. And there's actually a scene in Eastern Promises just before the steam bath where they're coming down the hall, and he says they like to have the meetings in the steam room because you can tell, you get to see what a man looks. You can see his tattoos.
Right,
right, right.
You know who you're dealing with.
Yeah, yeah. I remember reading an interview recently with Viggo Mortensen where he discussed how important those tattoos were.
Yes.
It even took 4 hours a day in makeup to put those on, but it was very important for his character.
Yes. So we passed the documentary around. We looked at books of tattoos, the tattoo art from the period. And then through the folk music, listening to the folk music, I started writing and, you know, thematic ideas all away from the film. Just thinking about the film. And then I create, you know, a series of pieces mm-hmm. based on the impressions of the film. And then there's a scoring process later on that actually is taking this music and scoring it, if you will, you know,
right.
to the film. You know, deciding where things go and how they're orchestrated. And, you know, it's a very linear process doing film music. It's a step, you know, it doesn't all happen at once. It's, you know, there's composition, orchestration, and then recording, which is performance, really, when
mm-hmm.
you're in the studio with the actual musicians, which is a whole part of the process in itself, and then the post process of editing and, you know, actually producing them.
And Cronenberg is a hands-on, has hands-on involvement. He's there with you every step of the way in the studio, or
he is. In a kind of mental, intuitive way,
mm-hmm.
you know, we'll talk on the phone a lot if we're not physically in the same place, but it's a constant dialogue, really.
Yeah.
And until we discover, you know, the truth of the story, discover the truth of it musically. I mean, sometimes it's difficult. It's not always easy working with people that you've worked, you know, as I say, because it's this constantly changing landscape. I remember when we were doing Spider, it was difficult to find the music sense of Spider because Spider didn't speak. You know, it was such an interior world, and music is a very interior world. It's a very emotional interior, practice, really, music. So to find Spider was difficult. I mean, it took a while to find that. And I think all of these films do. They all have their, you know, their discovery and their, you know, it takes a lot of work just to find the essence and the truth of the film.
Yeah, and that's what I love about Cronenberg's work is, you know, so many movies out there are carbon copies of another movie you've seen, but David Cronenberg's films, you've never seen those before. So I was discussing with Jerry, my co-host earlier in the show, you take a movie like Crash, you're seeing the movie Crash without a score, you're needing to come up with a musical voice for that film,
mm-hmm.
and it's unlike anything you've ever seen
yeah.
before. I cannot imagine how daunting that must be.
It is, and what you do, and I talked about this in Lord of the Rings, because we talked about daunting, you said it's a daunting, and I started on that project, and you felt like Frodo, you felt like this little hobbit, you know, you had this one, and you had to take this object to Mordor, a place you didn't know how to get there, where it was, how difficult it was going to be, and you just proceed, you know, with will power
mm-hmm.
and determination,
right.
and you know, discipline to do it, and you just proceed, and you just kind of go step by step. And you can't go from A to Z immediately. You have to go through the steps day by day. You know, it's kind of ritualistic in a way. And you just proceed in increments, and then suddenly you look behind you, and you have ideas and thoughts, and, you know, you're starting to create the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly there's 5 minutes of music, and then there's 10, and then there's 30. You know, you add to it. It's a very additive kind of mental discipline, really, composition.
Well, talking about building it a little at a time, you have the complete recordings for all three films. I believe Return of the King
right.
Is released on November 6.
Yes, we're just finishing it. Yes.
And it's something like 11 plus hours of music total, isn't it?
I think it's close. Well, it's 10 CDs in total. Are part of the complete recordings. 3 for Fellowship, 3 Two Towers, and four for Return of the King. And it's as complete, you know, as I can do right now. I mean, without any outtakes or rarities or anything.
Right.
I mean, there's actually more music, but I mean, some of it wasn't used in the film. I mean, what I put on the complete recordings is everything that was used in the films. There's 4 CDs of music in Return of the King extended version, the long version.
Wow.
Oh, what a staggering accomplishment.
And so it's all been remastered. It's been edited into tracks. Doug Adams' liner notes are fantastic. You know, there's 50 pages of liner notes for each edition. And then Doug is working on a standalone book next year. For all of the music for the trilogy, and we've been working on it. The releases it took 3 years, one year for each edition. So really, the work on Lord of the Rings I started in 2000. It's now 7 years.
Mm.
Well,
that's a journey, right there. tell me about the symphony performances for your Lord of the Rings score that have been taking place.
The symphony is it's a six movement piece for symphony orchestra, for mixed choir, adult choir, children's choir, soloists, and there's some folk instruments as well in it. It's the total instrumentation is 225 on stage, and it's a 2-hour and 10-minute piece. It's a narrative work that takes you through the world of Middle Earth, through Lord of the Rings, in that amount of time. Really, it's not everything that was created, but it's really what was able to be played in a concert performance in one sitting.
Oh.
And it's had, I think, about 140 performances all over the world, in the Far East and in Europe and Australia, New Zealand, the United States, Canada. And I've done many performances. I did a lot in 2004. This year I did one at the Blossom Festival with the Cleveland Orchestra, which is a great, amazing orchestra that I love. And that's the second time I performed with them of the symphony. And now I'm getting ready for a performance in Paris at the Châtelet Theater in November 2nd and 3rd.
Oh.
And there's other conductors that play the work. So, you know, the symphony was really a way to give the work life. So it just didn't have these recordings, or it just didn't exist in the film.
Right.
It now can be played, and with real orchestras playing it, and and singers and children's choir, and it's a very community type event. I mean, you mentioned the Cincinnati orchestra is playing it this coming weekend, mm-hmm. and if you're in Cincinnati this week, you'll see like the choirs are rehearsing for it, the children are learning Tolkien's music, all in Cincinnati. All that comes as a conductor to do it, and it's all done with the Cincinnati community. And so it's really a wonderful kind of music making event, and it's great for in the community, and it really seems to have a great community type of feeling to it.
And how satisfying must that be, that on a global level, that your score is means so much to so many people. It's moving people so much.
Mm.
That's just an amazing, amazing accomplishment, The Lord of the Rings. We actually have an email question for you.
Okay.
And it's concerning one of my all-time favorite scores, which is from The Fly.
Yes.
It's a very heightened and operatic score, so it makes sense that you're in the process of basing an opera around that concept. How is that shaping up?
The opera is finished compositionally. Piano vocal score was finished in the spring, and I'm orchestrating the piece now, and I'm going to Paris. The premiere is in Paris at the Châtelet in June 30th. This coming year, 2008, and it's a co-commission between Châtelet and Los Angeles Opera. It goes to Los Angeles in September.
Hmm.
And The Fly was something that I had thought about for many years. I thought it was a good opera subject. I became interested in opera in the early 80s, and I started thinking of film music in that way. I learned a lot about writing film music from studying opera, but I stayed away from it for a long time until I felt I was ready. And then after writing this much music for Lord of the Rings, which is essentially an opera work, it uses Tolkien's languages. His five languages are used in the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And the music for the film is essentially, it's based around voices, choral music, and soloists. And there's many singers that I wrote for in the course of that 10 or 11 hours of music. And so having done that, I felt maybe I was ready for the opera. And I wanted to work with something that I was comfortable with, that I knew. And so I always thought The Fly was a good subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I met Plácido, and he I told him about it. He became interested in it. He commissioned it for L.A. And so I've been working on it for 2 years, and this is my last year now of orchestration and the rehearsals. I'm doing a workshop with David Cronenberg in Paris next week.
So he is, Mr. Cronenberg is involved?
Yes, in directing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yes,
great,
yes.
Great.
Dante Ferretti did the production design, designer.
Incredible.
David Henry Wong wrote a wonderful libretto, incredible libretto, and it's cast now, and it's just such a wonderful thing to work on. I mean, I love it. I love the form so much.
Yeah.
And it's just a great, great gift for me as a composer to work on it.
Well, I can't let you go without asking about two of my favorite talents that you've worked with. And one is Martin Scorsese. For the past few years, fairly regularly, you've with The Aviator and The Departed and some of his future projects, you've collaborated with him. It seems like if there is any director out there that is a musical director, he is definitely one.
Yes.
What's that like, that collaboration like?
Well, Marty loves music, as we know, and that's always been a great bond between us because we both love it so much.
Right.
So, and we're constantly passing ideas back and forth to each other. So that's really been a great part of the working together. And I met Marty and Selma Schoonmaker in the Brill Building in 1986.
Wow.
And I did a film with them called After Hours.
Yes.
And then I've worked with them on five productions now, I think, and they're just incredible to work with, Marty and Selma, and they're just great filmmakers. They're brilliant people to work with. They're funny and creative, and they challenge you, and you grow, and we try things, and it's just a very fluid, wonderful relationship and collaboration. And you see that in the films, I think. And Marty's like that with everybody who's working with in films, because there's so much love for the art of making films. And we all, you know, appreciate that. And so it's a nice place to work when you're working with Marty.
Oh, I bet it is. And his next project is the Rolling Stones concert film, The Shine a Light.
Yes.
And what a perfect
pairing. Such a great documentary filmmaker. I mean, the Dylan documentary was just breathtaking.
Oh, I love that documentary.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
I also have to ask about the last person I need to ask you about, because I'm kind of a super geeky fan of this man's work, and that's Al Pacino. you worked with him Looking for Richard.
Yes.
That was a big passion project of his. What was that? What was that experience like?
Well, it was actually a wonderful project because I love working with writers, and you know, I've done other literary adaptions besides Tolkien, G.G. Ballard's Crash, William Burroughs' Naked Lunch, and now Shakespeare. How wonderful to work with Shakespeare! And that just opened up a lot of creative ideas. The text for the score that I wrote is a Latin text. It was written by Elizabeth Cotnoir for the film, and I worked with a choir. It was recorded in a church. Al came. It was just it's just such a lovely thing when the director and the composer are interested in the same word, the writer.
Yeah.
You know, because you're really going back to the source. Like, both of us are looking at Richard and really expressing ideas about Richard. And that's, Looking for Richard is about Al Pacino's, search for the truth in Richard III. And as a composer, you're doing the same thing. So you're really on the same wavelength, the same journey, and I think the work was good on that, very good.
It was. It was fantastic. In any stories I can get about Pacino, I grab them wherever I can.
Yeah.
Mr. Shore, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yes, really, thank you.
You are more than welcome to join us anytime in the future. Just say the word. But thank you so much.
I look forward to that. That'd be good.